It was, MacDonald said, a wonderful feat for a woman of her age and physique. She appeared very frail and, to succeed as she had, called for immense courage and vitality. During the Second World War, Madame Dade Neal spent several years on the Chinese-Tibetan frontier, often suffering real privation, cut off as she was from her funds in France. But she was a keen observer, and learned a great deal about China's far west and the intrigues of the border country. In 146, a peasant girl brings home the bacon, in this case a butchered sheep. Buddhist doctrine forbids killing animals and eating their meat, but in Tibet an exception to the rule is made in the case of sheep and yak. 147 1946 she returned to France and to her home in the Bass Alps, where, at more than 80 years of age, she is still working quietly on her researches in Tibetan religion and literature. She won a victory for herself, but Tibet is still closed. 10. The final push to Lhasa. Continuing our longest day's march, we came to one of the highest and most beautiful lakes in the world, Yamrock Tso, the Turquoise Lake, or Lake of the Upland Pastures. This freshwater lake is at an altitude of more than 14,000 feet and runs 60 miles through the Himalayas. Approaching the village and lofty fort of Nygat Zong on the shore of the lake, we overtook a man who was loping along with a sack on his back and a spear in his hand. He was one of the Tibetan mail carriers. They travel on foot, running most of the way. The spear is the carrier's badge of office. After 5 or 6 miles, another man seizes the mail bag. It is a day-and-night relay race against time between Lhasa and Giants, where the Indian government takes over the postal service to India. As we rode up to his heels, he turned without stopping, stuck out his tongue in the Tibetan polite greeting and challenged us to a race, he on foot, carrying the mail, our party on horseback. It was a neck-and-neck race. At Nygats we inquired at once for the Thunderbolt Tso. Colonel Tolstoy of the OSS had told about his visit to her during the war. The abbess of an Almail monastery on the hill above Yamdrok Tso, she is the holiest woman in Tibet. Regarded as an incarnation of Dorpamu, the Thunderbolt Tso, she is supposed to have the power to transform herself into a sow. The story goes that one of the early Thunderbolt Tsos transformed not only herself but all the lamas in her monastery into pigs when an enemy army threatened the monastery. The invaders were so frightened that they fled. Anyway, that's the way the tale runs. Tibet teems with strange tales, and the story of the Thunderbolt Tso is one of the strangest. The Dorpamu is the only Tibetan woman permitted to ride in a palanquin, also the only one who is blessed by the hand of the Dalai Lama instead of being touched by the red tassel at the end of a short wand, as are all other women and commoners. When Tolstoy visited Nygats in 1942, the present incarnation was 5 years old. Now she is 13. We were eager to meet and film the little abbess, but her monastery, Samden Gompa, 5 or 6 miles from Nygats, was difficult to reach because of the floods. So we had to be satisfied with the incredible and wondrous stories relayed to us about the Thunderbolt Tso and with predictions of the fate probably in store for the 13-year-old abbess. Tibet's number one oracle, we were informed, was about to look into the past and the future and pronounce whether she was the true Dorpamu or whether a nun in another part of Tibet was the genuine incarnation of the original sacred Tso and should replace the present occupant. Another day along the shores of the enchanting Yamrock Tso brought us to the village of Pedi, where we spent the night. As we rode away from Pedi the next morning, the sun broke through for a few moments, and we noticed numerous gulls and bar-headed geese. Our caravan was about to ford a 152 stream near the shore of the lake when we observed that the waters were black with swarms of brown trout, fighting their way upstream to spawn. Norbu, the cook, with his mind on the evening meal, waded into the stream and in a few minutes had scooped out with his bare hands 16 beautiful brownies, ranging in length from 10 to 14 inches. The few towns around the lake might easily support themselves on the fish of Yamdrok Tso, but fishing in Tibet, like hunting and mining, is forbidden for religious reasons. According to Sir Charles Bell, fish, pork and some poultry and eggs are believed to contain black pills. Due to the wicked crimes, usually the destruction of many lives committed by the animals in the previous incarnation, Tibetans avoid eating any food which contains these black pills, convinced that such a sacrilege will bring down on them serious spiritual harm and misfortune. Our third and final pass on the way to the holy city was 16,200-foot Nyapsola, which separates Yamdrokso from the valley of the great Brahmaputra. Far up in the clouds at the summit of Nyapsa we paused to look back at this most enchanting of lakes. The sun broke through for a few moments, brilliantly intensifying the blue-green waters, set like a precious jewel in a glorious circle of mountains. Passing a yak caravan near the prayer flags at the top of the pass, we saw the Brahmaputra far below through breaks in a bank of cloud wisps. The descending trail was so steep and so badly washed out that we dismounted to give our panting ponies a break. Scrambling over the slippery grass and rocks, we worked our way down to the Brahmaputra, winding and turning through the valley more than 4,000 feet below. Another night in a Tibetan hut in Singlakanjung, a town on the south bank of the Brahmaputra. Then we had the fun of riding in comfort down the river in skin boats. Our two coracles were made of yak skin stretched taut over a frame, work of willow ribs. The Tibetans call these flat-bottomed boats garwals. They are about 10 feet long, 6 feet wide at the blunt end and 2 feet wide at the other end, where the oarsmen sit. Our garwals, carrying us and our baggage with the greatest of ease, were lashed together at their blunt ends. Their sides were about 3 feet high and they were held together by tough yak-hide thongs. The oars were almost as unusual as the boats. To the end of a long pole, apparently of cedar, were lashed 2 flat pieces of wood to serve as a paddle. Each of these strange, light river boats can carry the loads of 20 pack animals, more than a ton of freight. In our coracles were squeezed 8 persons in addition to the loads, and of course the 2 kobos, the leather-skinned boatmen. They sang a boat song, curious and haunting to our Western ears, as they struggled to keep us in midstream. We made a recording of their singing on our portable machine. Later Dad was told that his description of the boat trip, combined with the kobos singing, was one of his most popular broadcasts from Tibet. We were now headed down the Brahmaputra for the 16 miles to Chusel, to begin the final push to Lhasa. In our skin coracles we were rushing along at about 10 miles per hour. Just before coming into sight of Chusel we raced through a narrow gorge between high cliffs. On one was perched a monastery, and any number of Buddhas were painted on the rocks to pacify the river demons. The gorge was filled with prayer flags, some planted in regimental lines out into the river, doubtless to protect coracles from the evil spirits and to guide boatmen away from submerged rocks. Rounding a rocky promontory, we were in Chusel, situated at the point where the Kayachuti is, raging, into the Brahmaputra. Our kobos had a strenuous job to pull us out of the clutches of the current, but, aided by lusty shouts and the rhythm of their boat song, they succeeded. The Tibetan boatmen cannot row their coracles upstream against the roaring current. When we reached Chusel, our kobos had to carry their skin boats back home along the river bank. Every boatman takes a pet sheep on the journey downstream. On the homeward trek, the sheep carries the boatman's personal effects. Nowhere else in the world have I seen sheep used as pets and pack animals. From Chusel to Lhasa was only 40 miles, and we expected to cover that distance easily in 2 days. But the Kayachu was at its highest flood level in 4 years. Some of the time we could avoid the flood by staying high on the valley slopes. More than once, however, rock walls hemmed us in, forcing our caravan to wade into the river. Those were tricky moments as our donkeys struggled up to their big ears in water, with their loads half in, half out. We were not concerned about the food boxes, but to keep our precious film and recording apparatus dry we had hired 4 extra coolies. Plowing without pants through the current, they were as funny a sight as the donkeys. After a pleasant night at Chiang Mai Tilda copyright in a peasant's home, we found the going next morning even more difficult. Many times the caravan had to be unloaded. It took 10 coolies to move all our gear across the bad spots. At one spot the water was so deep that the smaller donkeys had to swim, and even the coolies had a hard time keeping loads dry. In Tibet it is considered good manners and good luck to end a long journey in the forenoon. That is why we halted for the night at a village 7 miles from Lhasa. Impatient as we were to reach our destination after toiling for 23 days over the rugged Himalayas. Early the next morning our train of 22 mules set forth in the rain. We had only one day with our train in our 28-day journey from Calcutta. Passing a number of enormous Buddhas carved and painted on the cliffs, we rounded a mountain and at its foot came to a long wall behind which a vast, sprawling cluster of stone buildings climbed, tier upon tier, up the lower slope. This was Drepung, the largest monastery in the world, housing 10,000 monks. As we rode by this tremendous center, dedicated to Jamaism, two men a short distance ahead on the trail dismounted and walked toward us. Naturally, we dismounted, too. One apparently was a Tibetan official and the other his aide. Dressed in bright red and purple silk robes and wearing a canary yellow inverted bowl hat, the official introduced himself in halting English as Dorcheng Wuba. He announced that His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, had assigned to him the honor of acting as our host during our stay in the Forbidden City. Dor explained that he knew only a little English, learned from his late father, who was one of four boys who had attended school at Rugby, in England, the only Tibetans ever sent to Europe for an education. It came about in this way. When the 13th Dalai Lama was living in self-imposed exile in Darjeeling to avoid capture by the Chinese invaders of his country, Sir Charles Bell advised him to send a few Tibetan boys to school in England. His Holiness thought that a good idea, so after his return to Tibet in 1912 he selected four boys of the upper middle class from the ages of 12 to 15. Accompanied to England by an English official working in Tibet and by a Tibetan official and his wife, the boys were enrolled at the celebrated rugby school in 1913. One was to learn mining engineering, another was chosen for a military career, the third was to study electrical engineering, and the fourth, telegraphy and surveying. The few years the Tibetans spent in England were not enough for them to become expert in these fields, especially when the English language had to be mastered first. But it is pleasant to know that they made many friends, and entered heartily into the games, sports and fun of their English schoolmates. The lad who studied mining engineering set about exploring for gold and other minerals when he got home. But as soon as he started to dig, the abbot from the nearest monastery objected, insisting that he replace the stones and move away because the local spirits were being disturbed. After several futile attempts, he abandoned mining and went into government work. Three of the Rugbeians died at a comparatively early age, some say under mysterious circumstances. Perhaps the more fanatical among the lamas did not approve of this new, fangled Western education polluting their sacred land. The experiment was never tried a second time. We were soon to meet the sole survivor of the rugby quartet. We crossed the Kyachu River, which flows past Lhasa, over a modern steel bridge, strangely incongruous in this medieval setting of temples, courtens and monasteries. Built in the late 1930s at the insistence of Zarong Shapay Tilda Copyright, the wealthiest man in Tibet and one of its most progressive elder statesmen, the bridge had to be carried by coolies and mules over the mountains, beam by beam, bolt by bolt. When it was assembled at Lhasa, Zarong Shape supervised its construction. The bridge was thronged with pilgrims heading into the holy city for the colorful wind-up of the week-long annual dance festival then underway. Every devout follower of Tibet's God King tries to make at least one pilgrimage to Lhasa each year, usually during some festive period such as the Summer Dance Carnival or the three-week New Year celebration in February. Among those who come to pay homage are such zealots as the Nilas, who make the entire journey from their home to the capital on torn and bloody knees, and the Rollas, who prostrate themselves at every step, measuring each mile with the length of their bodies like inchworms. Some of these pious and painful excursions take 3 years. My pulse quickened as we rode through the Pago Caling. The western gate and archway cut through an imposing courtyard, and found ourselves directly under the Potala. That fabulous and monumental building dominates the whole landscape around Lhasa and always presents another fascinating perspective, no matter from what part of the city or nearby countryside it is viewed. With the gold-roofed Potala, the monasteries and temples glistening in the sun, the crowds of people in their gay, picturesque costumes, Lhasa seemed to me like a rich illustration from a medieval manuscript. "There just aren't any words for it," Dad said, radiant and happy on fulfilling at last his 30-year ambition. "Lhasa is truly out of this world, scenically, geographically and culturally. Standing at the head of a green valley only 12,000 feet above sea level low for Tibet, the city is almost surrounded by tall mountains, the highest of which looms up 18,000 feet. Even in the summer, new snow can be seen almost every morning on the majestic peaks towering toward the deep blue sky. To add to the splendor, scattered up and down the mountains are red and white monasteries, some of which cling precariously to rock cliffs like eagles' nests." Dawn now led us away from the center of the city, across several flooded meadows to what was to be our home while visiting Lhasa. He took us to a government villa, called Tredelinga, on the southern outskirts and almost on the banks of the Kaichu. There we found ample room and comfort both for our animals and ourselves. There was no plumbing, but we had long since become accustomed to that omission. Our quarters were spacious, clean and well ventilated by a multitude of open windows covered with cheesecloth. While we were setting up our cots and stowing away our personal belongings, Dor excused himself. He returned in 30 minutes accompanied by a half-dozen servants laden with presents from his government. The gifts were food and much appreciated, for we had become exceedingly bored with our canned rations. The generous assortment included a recently butchered lamb, several sacks of barley, trays of cabbage and large Tibetan radishes, and a heaping platter of eggs which, happily for our stomachs, were not altogether ancient. We were even more delighted with the tin bathtub Dor sent over from his house. We had been more than a week on the trail since our last tub in Giants. There always has been a strict rule that a visitor to Lhasa must pay his respects to the Dalai Lama before he sees any other persons of importance. But the custom is that 3 days, at least, must pass before he is permitted to enter the audience hall where the Tibetan pontiff blesses pilgrims, usually only from China, Bhutan, Sikkim, Nepal and India, the nearby Buddhist countries. Well, for the first time in Tibetan history, so they said, that rule was disregarded. We happened to arrive on the eve of the final day of the summer festival. A Central Asian pageant, unchanged in centuries, this celebration takes place every year during the first week of the Tibetan seventh month. The real climax comes on the last day, when the entire population of Lhasa is entertained by the Dalai Lama, all the officials, their families, the army and the commoners. The Lhasa authorities didn't want us to miss the grand finale. So, for once, in this land where tradition and custom mean so much, they decided to make an exception. A breathless messenger in robes of red and gold brought the news. We were to come to the Dalai Lama's summer palace at Norbulinga, Jewel Park. The closing day of the summer festival dawned bright and clear over Lhasa, with plenty of sunlight for our color film. Early in the morning we joined the stream of Tibetans on the Tamil procession to Norbulinga. We rode leisurely past the towering Potala, dismounting every few minutes to film the colorful crowd in their bright, fantastic costumes. Never had we seen more photogenic people. Tibetan officials and their wives were riding gaily ornamented horses and mules, the men dressed in flowing robes, with yellow hats of the inverted saucer type. The color scheme of their silk robes varied according to rank and office, some gold and blue, others orange and red. The wives, who brought up the rear, were decked out in iron silk dresses of bright blue, with green and blue hats that had 12-inch visors to protect their complexions from the intense high-altitude rays of the sun. Some women wore on their heads wooden frames studded with turquoise and coral. Over these frames, which looked like antlers, they draped their long straight hair. The ordinary townspeople, proceeding on foot, were no less colorful, perhaps not dressed so elegantly, but just as gaily. Some of the men wore large fur caps that for centuries have been a characteristic feature of the Mongol costume, and many had on the curious Tibetan cloth boots with flat soles of yak hide. Now and then we came upon vendors selling small blocks of hard yak cheese, 30 or 40 fastened on a string, cigarettes labeled Virginia 10s and hard candy from India. Every few minutes we were approached by beggars spinning prayer wheels and chanting their pleas for alms. Begging, by the way, is a recognized way of life in Buddhist countries. To refuse beggars is believed to draw a curse. The entrance to Norbilingo is flanked by two stone dragons. Passing under a delicately carved wooden archway, we stepped into a park of poplar trees and bright flowers. A dense crowd of Tibetans was gathered around an open-air platform about 100 feet square. This was the stage, shaded from the sun by a huge roof-like awning, painted in glowing colors. A drama almost as old as Tibet itself was being enacted to the accompaniment of drums and cymbals. Our guide, Dorcheng Wibba, led us through the throng to seats of honor at the far end of the stage. The we sat under a canopy on divans covered with red, yellow and blue silk. We were only about 40 feet from the Dalai Lama, but we had to be careful when taking our places. The pontiff must not see us. This was a matter of protocol. Since we had not yet been received by the priest king, we were not officially present. To our left, in the adjoining pavilion, were groups of high lamas. In the next pavilion sat the Dalai Lama and his party, blocked off from our view by a partition, but we were able to see his mother, brother and sister in a booth diagonally across from ours. To the left of the Dalai Lama was the pavilion for the nine cabinet ministers, wearing brilliant yellow silk gowns and red hats. More ministers and high government officials occupied the remaining booths. At the back of the stage and on either side stood the commoners and soldiers. In front of us the actors were alternately dancing and singing, acting out their ancient tale. They drifted on and off the stage and props were changed without between act curtains, as in the old Chinese plays. The narrative was so swift and complicated that even our hosts from the Foreign Office were unable to understand it all. But they were familiar enough with the drama, which continued without pause for 10 hours, from 7 in the morning until 5 in the afternoon, to tell us that it concerned a Muslim king and an incarnate Buddha. The king, hoping to kill the living Buddha, sends him on a dangerous ocean voyage to obtain sunken jewels in waters guarded by serpents and demons. The living Buddha is attacked in his boat by the sea monsters, but after a long struggle he succeeds in recovering the jewels from the ocean floor, thus foiling the Muslim king. There is a touch of Superman in some of these ancient Tibetan religious dramas. The whole plot was vividly unfolded by the actors as they danced and sang. They even indicated a boat going through all the motions of sailing a rough sea, and showed in pantomime the struggle with the serpents. A gong sounded at midday, and we adjourned for lunch with the lamas and government officials. We ate with the Tibetan officials in a courtyard decorated with grotesque carvings of Buddhist animals and multicolored reliefs. Sitting Buddha fashion, with legs tucked under, we were served slabs of pasty yak cheese, bowls of rice and raisin pudding, and coarse barley bread. The meal was washed down with cups of Tibet's favorite beverage, thick yak butter tea. Then back to the play. Soon Oriental hats began to nod, official stomachs were a bit too full. Just as we were recovering from lunch, we were led off to another repast with Tsepan Shekhabpa, Tibet's Minister of Finance and the leader of the first trade mission to the outside world in 1948. Rimshi Kayapup, lone survivor of the four youths who went to school at Rugby, served as our interpreter at this affair. When Kayapup returned from England he tried to develop Tibet's telegraph system, but the government at that time showed no interest in the project and he abandoned it. Kayapup has held positions as head of the city police and as city magistrate. Short and rather shy, with a deferential manner, he is married to one of the beautiful daughters of Tering Raja, who is a member of the royal family of Sikkim. The Rimshi, with his good command of English, is often called upon to interpret at interviews between high officials and English-speaking visitors. The finance minister seemed to enjoy talking about his trip to America, where he stayed for 4 months with his five-man trade mission. Their work, promoting United States-Tibetan trade, took them across the states as far as California. Sepun Shekhabpa had been utterly bewildered by our machinery, our trains, planes, autos and San Francisco's cable cars. He had high praise for the hotels where they stayed, and marveled at the comforts and efficiency of the city of San Francisco, which sped them to the West Coast. The Rocky Mountains and the Sierras reminded the delegation of their own Himalayas, while the Hudson River made them a little homesick for the Kaichu. Sepun Shekhabpa was especially impressed with the American universities he had visited, and hoped that his government would send a few promising young Tibetans to school over here. His only real disappointment in America was not being recognized as a Tibetan. He said some folks thought he was Chinese, others took him for Indian, others Japanese. But strangest of all, he said, was being confused with the British. It just goes to show how ignorant we Americans are about Tibet. Sepun Shekhabpa realizes that Tibet must be brought before the American public and described to the world if it is to enlarge its circle of friends and win outside support in its struggle against the red tide. It was this forward-looking finance minister's influence which enabled us to visit Tibet. He convinced the Haile Selassie authorities that the people of America should know something about their country, both through words and photographs, and persuaded them to take a chance on us. From lunch in number 2 we returned to our seats at the folk play. Shortly afterward, young acolyte monks passed around heaping trays of bread. How anyone could have a crumb of appetite after such feasting was beyond our comprehension, but we were obliged to dig in with the others. The bread was followed by tea. Incidentally, the average well-to-do Tibetan consumes his thick tea at the fantastic rate of 40 to 50 cups a day. A little later, still almost stupefied with overeating, we went back of the pavilions to photograph the army. A private show was put on for us while guards, wielding long wooden staves, unmercifully beat back the curious crowd of commoners to clear a path for our cameras. The National Army then numbered about 10,000 men, but we have heard that it has now been increased to nearly 100,000. It is the only Tibetan institution that has been changed in centuries. The Dalai Lama's troops, for the most part, are clad in native costume, but a few hundred wear the discarded British uniform of World War I, with rifles and other light equipment of the same period. The army had three bands performing and a corps of bagpipers. Just listen to them, Dad. Of all things, they are playing a medley of God Save the King, Marching Through Georgia, and Auld Lang Syne. And not badly either, considering how utterly different their music is from ours, Dad replied. Most likely the bagpipes and the old familiar Western tunes floated into Lhasa on the wave of British influence that followed the young Usmund expedition, I ventured. After our special army show we returned to our seats to see the conclusion of the dance drama. Three towering monks appeared. Brawny as professional wrestlers, and as tall as the giant in America's favorite circus, they were part of the Dalai Lama's personal bodyguard. The ground fairly trembled as this overpowering trio stepped forward, arms filled with kuttas for the actors. These white silk scarves, which the actors received around their necks, probably had money tied in them. Again they danced, more wildly than before, costumes and scarves went flying in all directions. And as they gyrated they paused, one after the other, to scoop cupfuls of barley flour from a huge tub, then on they danced. Suddenly all the whirling stopped. In a final, auspicious gesture the players gave vent to piercing cries as they tossed into the air the flour from their cups. Then, all together, they fell face down in the direction of their God King's pavilion. The Earth Bull Summer Festival was over. That night we put our portable radio equipment to work and made the first broadcast in history from Lhasa. This we rushed out to India by courier, and on to our radio colleagues in New York. While awaiting an official audience with the Dalai Lama, we took advantage of the next few days to do some sightseeing. Lhasa itself is a collection of whitewashed buildings, mostly of stone and from 1 to 4 stories high, built along a maze of narrow, rutted streets. Around the city we observed hordes of yellow grain and herds of grazing yak.